then continued after her, pleased that his strength was holding. He could manage Teft without light. Despite Kaladin's last few weeks spent as a surgeon, his body was still that of a soldier.
"We should go higher," Syl said, floating alongside his head as a ribbon of light. "Can you manage?"
"Get us to floor 10 at least," Kaladin said.
"I'll have to take us up stairwells as I see them. I don't really know this section of the tower."
He let himself sink into an old, familiar mindset as they continued. Teft's weight across his shoulders wasn't that different from carrying a bridge. It brought him back to those days, running bridges, eating stew, watching his friends die, feeling terror anew each day. Those memories offered no comfort, but the rhythm of steps, carrying a burden, working his body on an extended march, it was at least familiar. He followed Syl up one set of steps, then another. Then across another long tunnel, the strata here waving vigorously like ripples in a churning pond. Kaladin kept moving, until suddenly he came alert. He couldn't pinpoint what alarmed him, but he moved on instinct to immediately cover his sphere and duck into a side passage. He stepped into a nook and knelt to slide Teft off his shoulders. He pressed his hand against the unconscious man's mouth to silence his mumbling. Syl darted over a moment later. He could see her in the darkness, but she didn't illuminate things around her. He shoved his other hand in his pocket, tightly holding the sphere so it couldn't give off any betraying illumination.
"What?"
Syl asked. Kaladin shook his head. He didn't know, but didn't want to speak. He huddled there, hoping Teft wouldn't mutter or shift too loudly, his own heartbeat thumping in his ears. Then, faint red light crept into the hallway he'd left. Syl immediately zipped to hide her light behind Kaladin's dark form. The light approached, revealing a single ruby along with a pair of glowing red eyes. Those illuminated a terrible face, pure black with hints of marbled red under the eyes, long dark hair which appeared woven into his simple wrap of clothing. It was the creature Kaladin had fought in Hearthstone, the one he'd killed in the burning room of the mansion. Though the fused had been reborn into a new body, Kaladin knew from the skin patterns that it was the same individual. Come for revenge. The fused didn't seem to spot Kaladin hiding in the darkness, though he did pause at the intersection for an extended period of time. He moved on, thankfully, going deeper along the path Kaladin had been taking. Storms. Kaladin had defeated the thing last time without any stormlight, but he had done so by playing on its arrogance. Kaladin doubted it would let him get such an easy kill again.
Those singers in the clinic. One of them mentioned that a fused was looking for me. They called him the Pursuer.
This thing, it had come to the tower specifically to find Kaladin. "Follow it," he mouthed, turning to Syl, counting on her to understand his meaning.
"I'll find some place more secluded to hide."
She wove her line of light into a brief luminescent representation of a Kedja glyph, meaning affirmative, then zipped after the Pursuer. She couldn't get too far from Kaladin anymore, but she should be able to follow for a while. Hopefully she could do so circumspectly, as some of the fused could see Spren. Kaladin hauled Teft back up onto his shoulders, then struck out into the darkness, barely allowing himself any light. There was always something oppressive about being deep in the tower, feeling so far away from the sky and the wind, but it was worse in the darkness. He could all too easily imagine himself trapped in here without spheres, left to wander forever in a tomb of stone. He wove through a few more turns, hoping to find a stairwell up to another floor. Unfortunately, Teft started muttering again. Gritting his teeth, Kaladin ducked into the first room he found, a place with a narrow doorway. Here he set Teft down, then tried to stifle his noises. Syl darted into the room a moment later, which made Kaladin jump.
"He's coming," she hissed. "He went only a short distance down the wrong hallway before he stopped, inspected the ground, then doubled back. I don't think he saw me. I followed long enough to see him stop at the place where you hid a bit ago. He found a little smear of blood on the wall there. I hurried ahead of him, but he knows you're nearby."
Storms. Kaladin glanced at his bloody clothing, then at Teft, who was muttering despite Kaladin's attempts to quiet him.
"We need to lead the pursuer away," Kaladin whispered. "Be ready to distract him."
She made another affirmative signal. Kaladin left his friend as a restless lump in the darkness, then backtracked a little. He pulled up near an intersection, gripping his scalpel. He allowed no light other than Syl's, his few remaining infused spheres tucked away in his black pouch. He took a few deep breaths, then mouthed his plan to Syl. She sailed farther away through the black corridor, leaving Kaladin in total darkness. He'd never been able to find the pure emptiness of mind that some soldiers claimed to adopt in battle. He wasn't certain he'd ever want something like that. However, he did compose himself, making his breathing shallow, and came fully alert, listening. Loose, relaxed, but ready to come alight. Like tinder, waiting for the spark. He was ready to breathe in his last spheres of stormlight, but wouldn't until the last moment. Footsteps scraped the cord to Kaladin's right, and the walls slowly bled with red light. Kaladin held his breath, ready, his back to the wall. The pursuer froze just before reaching the intersection, and Kaladin knew the creature had spotted Syl, who would have zipped past in the distance. A heartbeat later, scraping noises announced the pursuer dropping his body as a husk, and a red ribbon of light rushed after Syl. The distraction had worked. Syl would lead him away. As far as they knew, the fused couldn't harm Spren naturally. The only way to do so was with a shard blade. Even that was temporary. Cut Spren with a shard blade, even rip them to pieces, and they eventually reformed in the cognitive realm. Experiments had proven that the only way to keep them divided was to store separate halves in gemstones. Kaladin gave it 10 heartbeats, then brought out a small sphere for light and dashed into the corridor, sparing a brief glance at the pursuer's discarded body, before running for the room where he'd put Teft. It was amazing what a jolt of energy came from being so close to a fight. He heaved Teft on his shoulders without trouble, then was jogging away in moments, almost as if he were infused with stormlight again. Using the light of the sphere, he soon found a stairwell. He almost rushed up it, but a faint light from above made him stop fast. Voices speaking to rhythms echoed from above. And from below, he realized. He left that stairwell, but two hallways over, he saw distant lights and shadows. He pulled into a side corridor, sweating in streams, fear-spren, like globs of goo, writhing up through the stone beneath him. He knew this feeling, scurrying through the darkness, people with lights searching in a pattern, hunting him. Breathing heavily, he hauled Teft through a different side passage, but soon spotted lights in that direction as well. The enemy was forming a noose, slowly tightening around his position. That knowledge sent him into flashbacks of the night when he'd failed Nalma and the others. A night when, like so many other times, he'd survived when everyone else had died. Kaladin wasn't a runaway slave anymore, but the sensation was the same.
"Kaladin," Syl said, zipping up to him. "I was leading him toward the edge of the level, but we ran into some regular soldiers and he turned back. He seemed to figure out I was trying to distract him."
"There are multiple squads up here," Kaladin said, pulling into the darkness. "Maybe a full company." Storms, the pursuer must have repurposed the entire force sent to go through homes on the 6th floor. He was shocked at the speed with which they'd set up the trap. He had to admit that was likely the result of him letting a soldier run and tell the others. Well, he doubted the enemy had found the time to appropriate one of Navani's maps of this level. They couldn't have managed to place people in every hallway or stairwell. The net closing around him had to have gaps. He began searching. Down a side corridor, he found shadowy figures approaching, and in the next stairwell. They were relentless and everywhere. Plus, he didn't know this area any better than they did. He twisted around through a group of corridors until he reached a dead end. A quick search of the nearby rooms showed no other exits, and he looked over his shoulder, hearing voices calling to one another. They spoke Azish, he thought, and to the rhythms. Feeling a sense of growing dread, he set Teft down, counted his few spheres, and took out his scalpel once more. Right. He'd need to take a weapon from the first soldier he killed. A spear, hopefully. Something with reach if he was going to survive a fight in these corridors. Syl landed on his shoulder and took the shape of a young woman, seated with her hands in her lap.
We have to try to punch through, Kaladin whispered. There's a chance they'll send only a couple men this direction. We kill them, then slip out of the noose and run.
She nodded. It didn't sound like a couple men, though, and he was reasonably certain he caught a harsher, louder voice among them. The pursuer was still tracking him, possibly by the faint marks of blood smeared on the walls or floor. Kaladin pulled Teft into one of the rooms, then positioned himself in the doorway to wait. Not calm, but prepared. He gripped his scalpel in a reverse grip, a hacking grip, for ramming into the space between carapace and neck. Standing there, he felt the weight of it all pressing down on him. The darkness, both inside and out. The fatigue, the dread. Gloom spren, like tattered pieces of cloth, faded in, as if banners attached to the walls.
Kaladin, Syl said softly. Could we surrender?
That fused isn't here to take me captive, Syl, he said.
If you die, I'll be alone again.
We've slipped out of tighter problems than this. He trailed off as he glanced at her, sitting on his shoulder, seeming far smaller than usual. He couldn't force the rest of the words out. He couldn't lie. Light began to illuminate the corridor coming toward him. Kaladin gripped his knife more tightly. A part of him seemed to have always known it would come to this. Alone, in the darkness, standing with his back to the wall, facing overwhelming numbers. A glorious way to die. But Kaladin didn't want glory. He'd given up on that foolish dream as a child.
Kaladin, Syl said. What's that? On the floor?
A faint violet light had appeared in the crook of the rightmost corner. Almost invisible, even in the darkness. Frowning, Kaladin left his post by the door, inspecting the light. There was a garnet vein in the stone here, and a small portion of it was glowing. As he tried to figure out why, the glow moved, running along the crystal vein. He followed it to the doorway, then watched it cross the hallway to the room on the other side. He hesitated only briefly before putting away his weapon and hauling Teft onto his shoulders once again. He stumbled across the hallway outside, and one of the approaching people said something in Azish. It sounded hesitant, as if they hadn't caught more than a glimpse of him. Storms! What was he doing? Chasing phantom lights like Starspren in the sky? In this small chamber, the light moved across the floor and up the wall, revealing what appeared to be a gemstone embedded deeply in the stone.
A fabrial? Syl said. Infuse it!
Kaladin breathed in some of his stormlight, then glanced over his shoulder. Voices outside and shadows. Rather than hold his stormlight for that fight, however, he did as Syl told him, pressing the light into the gemstone. He had maybe two or three chips worth left after that. He was practically defenseless. The wall split down the center. He gaped as the stones moved, but with a silence that defied explanation. They cracked open just wide enough to admit a person. Carrying Teft, he entered a hidden corridor. Behind him, the doorway smoothly slid shut, and the light in the gemstone went out. Kaladin held his breath as he heard voices in the room behind. Then he pressed his ear against the wall, listening. He couldn't make out much, an argument that seemed to involve the pursuer. Kaladin worried they had spotted the door closing, but he heard no scraping or pounding. They would spot the spren he'd drawn, though, and would know he was close. Kaladin needed to keep moving. The little violet light on the floor twinkled and moved, so he lugged Teft after it through another series of corridors. Eventually, they reached a hidden stairwell that, blessedly, was undefended. He climbed that, though each footfall was slower than the one before it, and exhaustion spren hounded him. He kept moving somehow, as the light led him to the 11th floor, and then into another dark room. The oppressive silence told him he'd reached a portion of the tower the enemy wasn't searching. He wanted to collapse, but the light pulsed insistently on the wall, and Syl encouraged him to look. Another embedded gemstone, barely visible. He used the last of his stormlight to infuse it, and slipped through the door that opened. In absolute darkness, Kaladin set Teft down, feeling the door closing behind. He didn't have the strength to inspect his surroundings. He instead slid to the cold stone floor, trembling. There, he finally let himself drift to sleep.
45. A bold heart, a keen and crafty mind. 9 years ago. Esho Nye had been told that mapping the world removed its mystery. Some of the other listeners insisted the wilderness should be left uncharted, the domain of the Spren and the Great Shells, and that by trying to confine it to paper, she risked stealing its secrets. She found this to be flat-out ridiculous. She attuned awe as she entered the forest, the trees bobbing with life-spren, bright green balls with white spines poking out. Closer to the shattered plains, most everything was flat, grown over by only the occasional rock bud. Yet here, not so far away, plants thrived in abundance. Her people made frequent trips to the forest to get lumber and mushrooms. However, they always took the exact same route. Up the river a day's walk inward, gather there, then return. This time she'd insisted on leaving the party, much to their concern. She'd promised to meet them again at their normal camp, after scouting the outer perimeter of the forest all the way around. After hiking around the trees for several days, she'd encountered a river on the other side. Now she could cut back through the heart of the forest and reach her family's camp from that direction. She'd bear with her a new map that revealed exactly how large the forest was, at least on one side. She started along the stream, attuned to joy, accompanied by swimming river spren. Everyone had been so worried about her being out in the storms alone. Well, she'd been out in storms a dozen times in her life and had survived with no trouble. Plus, she'd been able to move in among the trees for shelter. Her family and friends were concerned, nonetheless. They spent their lives living in a very small region, dreaming of the day they could conquer one of the 10 ancient cities at the perimeter of the Shattered Plains. Such a small-minded goal. Why not strike out? See what else there was to the world. But no, only one possible goal existed. Win one of the cities. Seek shelter behind crumbling walls, ignoring the barrier the woods provided. Esho Nye considered it proof that nature was stronger than the creations of listeners. This forest had likely stood when the ancient cities had been new. Yet this forest still thrived, and those were ruins. You couldn't steal the secrets from something so strong just by exploring it. You could merely learn. She settled down near a rock and unrolled her map, made from precious paper. Her mother was one of the few among all the families who knew the song of making paper, and with her help, Esho Nye had perfected the process. She used a pen and ink to sketch the path of the river as it entered the forest, then dabbed the ink until it was dry before re-rolling the map. Though she was confident, resolve attuned, the others' complaints had been particularly bothersome lately. "We know where the forest is and how to reach it. Why map its size? What will that help?" "The river flows this direction. Everyone knows where to find it. Why bother putting it on paper?" Too many of her family wanted to pretend the world was smaller than it was. Esho Nye was convinced that was why they continued to squabble with the other listener families. If the world consisted only of the land around the 10 cities, then fighting over that land made sense. But their ancestors hadn't fought one another. Their ancestors had turned their faces to the storm and marched away, abandoning their very gods in the name of freedom. Esho Nye would use that freedom. Instead of sitting by the fire and complaining, she would experience the beauties cultivation offered, and she would ask the best question of them all. "What will I discover next?" Esho Nye continued walking, judging the river's course. She used her own methods of counting the distance, then rechecked her work by surveying sites from multiple angles. The river continued flowing for days once a storm passed. How? When all other water had drained away or been lapped up? Why did this river keep going? Where did it start? Rivers and their carapace-covered spren excited her. Rivers were markers, guideposts, roadways. You could never get lost if you knew where the river was. She stopped for lunch near one of the bends and discovered a type of kremling that was green, like the trees. She'd never seen one that shade before. She'd have to tell Venli. Stealing nature's secrets, Eshonai said to annoyance. What is a secret but a surprise to be discovered? Finishing her steamed haspers, she put out her fire and scattered the flame spren before continuing on her way. By her guess, it would take her a day and a half to reach her family. Then if she left them again and rounded the other side of the forest, she'd have a finished picture of how it looked. There was so much to see, so much to know, so much to do, and she was going to discover it all. She was going to... What was that? She frowned, halting in her tracks. The river wasn't strong now. It would likely slow to a trickle by tomorrow. Over its gurgling, she heard shouts in the distance. Had the others come to find her? She hurried forward, attuning excitement. Perhaps they were growing more willing to explore. It wasn't until she was almost to the sounds that she realized something was very wrong with them. They were flat, no hint of a rhythm, as if they were made by the dead. A moment later, she rounded a bend and found herself confronted by something more wondrous and more terrible than she'd ever dared imagine. Humans. Dull form dread, with the mind most lost, Venli quoted. The lowest and one not bright. To find this form, one need banish the cost. It finds you and brings you to blight. She drew in a deep breath and sat back in their tent, proud. All 91 stanzas recited perfectly. Her mother, Jack Slim, nodded as she worked the loom. That was one of your better recitations, she said to Praise. A little more practice, and we can move to the next song. But I got it right. You mixed up the 7th and 15th stanzas, her mother said. The order doesn't matter. You also forgot the 19th. No, I didn't, Venli said, counting them in her head. Work form? Did I? You did, her mother said. But you needn't be embarrassed. You're doing fine. Fine? Venli had spent years memorizing the songs while Eshonai barely did anything useful. Venli was better than fine. She was excellent. Except she'd forgotten an entire stanza. She looked at her mother, who was humming softly as she worked the loom. The 19th stanza isn't that important, Venli said. Nobody is going to forget how to become a worker. And dull form. Why do we have a stanza about that? Nobody would willingly choose it. We need to remember the past, her mother said to the rhythm of the lost. We need to remember what we passed through to get here. We need to take care not to forget ourselves. Venli attuned annoyance, and then Jack Slim began to sing to the rhythms in a beautiful voice. There was something amazing about her mother's voice. It wasn't powerful or bold, but it was like a knife, thin, sharp, almost liquid. It cut Venli to the soul, and awe replaced her annoyance. No, Venli wasn't perfect, not yet, but her mother was. Jack Slim sang on, and Venli watched, transfixed, feeling ashamed of her earlier petulance. It was just so hard sometimes, sitting in here day after day memorizing while Eshonai played. The two of them were nearly adults, only a year off for Eshonai and a little more than 2 for Venli. They were supposed to be responsible. Her mother eventually trailed off after the 10th stanza. "Thank you," Venli said, "for singing something you've heard 1,000 times." "For reminding me," Venli said to Praise, "of what I am practicing to become." Her mother attuned joy and continued working. Venli strolled to the doorway of the tent and peered out, where family members worked at various activities, like chopping wood and felling trees. Her people were the First Rhythm family and had a noble heritage. They were thousands strong, but it had been many years since they'd controlled a city. They kept talking of winning one back soon, of how they'd strike out of the forest and attack before a storm, claiming their rightful seat. It was an excellent and worthy goal, yet Venli found herself dissatisfied as she watched warriors making arrows and sharpening ancient metal spears. Was this really what life amounted to? Fighting back and forth over the same 10 cities? Surely there was more for them. Surely there was more for her. She had come to love the songs, but she wanted to use them, find the secrets they promised. Would Roshar create someone like Venli, only to have her sit in a hog's hide tent and memorize words until she could pass them on, then die? No. She had to have some kind of destiny, something grand. "Eshenai thinks we should draw pictures to represent the verses of the songs," Venli said. "Make stacks of papers full of pictures so we won't forget." "Your sister has a wisdom to her at times," her mother said. Venli attuned betrayal. "She shouldn't be off away from the family so much, being selfish with her time. She should be learning the songs like me. It's her duty too, as your daughter." "Yes, you are correct," Jack Slim said. "But Eshenai has a bold heart. She merely needs to learn that her family is more important than counting the number of hills outside the camp."
"I have a bold heart," Venli said.
"You have a keen and crafty mind," her mother said. "Like your mother. Do not dismiss your own talents because you envy those of another."
"Envy? Her?"
Venli's mother continued weaving. She wasn't required to do such work. Her position as keeper of songs was lofty, perhaps the most important in the family. Yet her mother had always sought to keep busy. She said working her hands kept her body strong, while going over songs worked her mind. Venli attuned anxiety, then confidence, then anxiety again. She walked to her mother and sat on the stool next to her. Jack Slim projected confidence, even when doing something as simple as weaving. Her complex skin pattern of wavy red and black lines was among the most beautiful in the camp, like true marbled stone. Eshenai took after their mother's colorings. Venli, of course, took after her father, primarily white and red, her own pattern more like swirls. In truth, Venli's pattern had all three shades. Many people claimed they couldn't see the small patches of black at her neck, but she could pick them out. Having all three colors was very, very rare.
"Mother," she said to excitement, "I think I've discovered something."
"And what would that be?"
"I've been experimenting with different spren again, taking them into the storms."
"You were cautioned about this."
"You didn't forbid me. So I continued. Should we only ever do as we are told?"
"Many say we need no more than work form and mate form," her mother said to consideration. "They say that courting other forms is to take steps toward forms of power."
"What do you say?" Venli asked.
"You are always so concerned for my opinions. Most children, when they reach your age, start to defy and ignore their parents."
"Most children don't have you as a mother."
"Flattery," Jack Slim said to amusement.
"Not
Entirely, Venli said. She attuned resignation. Mother, I want to use what I've learned. I have a head full of songs about forms. How can I help wanting to try to discover them? For the good of our people. Jack's limb finally stopped her weaving. She turned on her stool and scooted closer to Venli, taking her hands. She hummed, then sang softly to praise. Just a melody, no words. Venli closed her eyes and let the song wash over her, and thought she could feel her mother's skin vibrating, feel her soul. Venli had done this as long as she could remember, relying on her and her songs, ever since her father had left, seeking the Eastern Sea. You make me proud, Venli, Jack Slim said. You've done well these last few years, memorizing after Eshonai gave up. I encourage you to seek to improve yourself. But remember, you must not become distracted. I need you. We need you. Venli nodded, then hummed the same rhythm, attuning praise to be in sync with her mother. She felt love, warmth, acceptance from those fingers, and knew whatever else happened, her mother would be there to guide her, steady her, with a song that pierced even storms. Her mother returned to her weaving, and Venli began to recite again. She went through the entire thing, and this time did not miss a stanza. When she was done, she waited, taking a drink of water and hoping for her mother's praise. Instead, Jack Slim gave her something better. Tell me, she said, of these experiments with Spren you've been doing. I'm trying to find war form, Venli said to anticipation. I've been staying near the edge of the shelter during storms and trying to attract the right Spren. It is difficult, as most Spren flee from me once the winds pick up. However, this last time I feel I was close. A pain Spren is the key. They're always around during storms. If I can keep one close to me, I think I can adopt the form. If she managed it, she'd become the first listener to hold war form in many generations. Ever since the humans and the singers of old destroyed one another in their final battle, this was something she could bring her people, something that would be remembered. Let's go speak with the five, Jack Slim said, standing up from beside the loom. Wait, Venli said, taking her arm and attuning tension. You are going to tell them what I said? About war form? Naturally. If you are going to continue on this path, we will want their blessing. Maybe I should practice more, Venli said, before we tell anyone. Jack Slim hummed to reprimand. This is like your refusal to perform the songs in public. You are afraid of exposing yourself to failure again, Venli. No, she said. No, of course not. Mother, I just think this would be better if I knew for certain it worked, before causing trouble. Why wouldn't someone want to be certain before inviting ridicule by failing? That did not make Venli a coward. She'd adopt a new form when nobody else had. That was bold. She wanted to control the circumstances. That was all. Come with me, Jack Slim said to Peace. The others have been discussing this. I approached them after you asked me before. I hinted to the elders that I thought adopting new forms might be possible, and I believe they are willing to try. Really? Venli asked. Yes. Come. They will celebrate your initiative. That is too rare for us in this form. It is far better than dull form, but it does affect our minds. We need other forms, despite what some might say. Venli felt herself attuning excitement as she followed her mother out of the tent. If she did obtain war form, would it open her mind? Make her even more bold? Quiet the fears and worries she often felt? She hungered for accomplishments, hungered to make their world better, less dull, more vibrant, hungered to be the one who carried her people to greatness, out of the creme and toward the skies. The five were gathered around the fire pit amid the trees, discussing offensive tactics for the upcoming battle. That mostly equated to which boasts to make and which warriors to let cast their spears first. Jack Slim stepped up to the elders and sang a full song to excitement, a rare delivery from the Keeper of Songs, and each stanza made Venli stand taller. Once the song was finished, Jack Slim explained what Venli had told her. Indeed, the elders were interested. They realized that new forms were worth the risk. Confident that she would not be rejected, Venli stepped forward and attuned victory. As she began, however, something sounded outside of town. The warning drums? The five hastened to grab their weapons, ancient axes, spears, and swords, each one precious and passed down for generations, for the listeners had no means of creating new metal weapons. But what could this be? No other family would attack them out here in the wilderness. It hadn't happened in generations, since the Puresong family had raided the Fourth Movement family in an attempt to steal their weapons. The Puresongers had been thoroughly shunned for that action. Venli stayed back as the elders left. She didn't wish to be involved in a skirmish, if indeed that was happening. She was an apprentice keeper of songs, and was far too valuable to risk in battle. Hopefully, whatever this was, it would be over soon, and she could return to basking in the respect of the elders. So it was that she was one of the last to hear about Eshonai's incredible discovery, among the last to learn that their world had forever been changed, and among the last to learn that her grand announcement had been utterly overshadowed by the actions of her reckless sister. 46. The Weight of the Tower. I approach this project with an equal mixture of trepidation and hope, and I know not which should rule. From Rhythm of War, page 1. Raboniel denied Navani's servants. The Fused apparently thought it would be a hardship for Navani to live without them, so Navani allowed herself a small moment of pride when she stepped out of her rooms on the first full day of Urethiru's occupation. Her hair was clean and braided, her simple hava pressed and neat, her makeup done. Washing in cold water hadn't been pleasant, but the fabrials weren't working, so it wasn't as if she could expect warm water, even if she had servants. Navani was led down to the library rooms in the basement of Urethiru. Raboniel sat at Navani's own desk, going through her notes. Upon arriving, Navani bowed precisely, just low enough to indicate obedience, but not low enough to imply subservience. The Fused pushed back the chair and leaned an elbow on the desktop, then made a shooing motion with a hummed sound to dismiss the guards. "What is your decision?" the Fused asked. "I will organize my scholars, Ancient One," Navani said, "and continue their research under your observation."
"The wiser choice, and the more dangerous one, Navani Kulin," Raboniel hummed a different tone. "I do not find the schematics for your flying machine in these notes."
Navani made a show of debating it, but she'd already considered this issue. The secrets of the flying platform would be impossible to keep. Too many of Navani's scholars knew them. Beyond that, many of the new style of conjoined fabrials, which allowed lateral motion while maintaining elevation, were already in use around the tower. Though fabrials didn't work, Raboniel's people could surely discern their operation. After a long debate with herself, she'd come to the conclusion that she needed to give up this secret. Her best hope in escaping the current predicament was to appear to be willing to work with Raboniel, while also stalling. I intentionally don't keep priority schematics anywhere but in my own head, Navani lied. Instead, I explain each piece I need built to my scholars as I need them. Given time, I can draw for you the mechanism that makes the machine work. Raboniel hummed to a rhythm, but Navani couldn't tell what it represented. However, Raboniel seemed skeptical as she stood and waved for Navani to sit down. She placed a reed in Navani's hands and folded her arms to wait. Well, fine. Navani began drawing with quick, efficient lines. She made a diagram of a conjoined fabrial, with a quick explanation of how it worked. Then she drew the expanded vision of hundreds of them embedded into the flying machine. Yes, Raboniel said, as Navani sketched the last portions. But how do you make it move laterally? Surely with this construction, you could raise a machine high in the air, but it would have to remain there in one place. You don't expect me to believe that you have a ground machine moving in exact coordination to the one in the sky. You understand more about fabrials than I assumed, Lady of Wishes. Raboniel hummed a rhythm. I am a quick learner. She gestured to the notes on Navani's desk. In the past, my kind found it difficult to persuade Spren to manifest themselves in the physical realm as devices. It seems Void Spren are not as naturally self-sacrificing as those of honor or cultivation. Navani blinked as the implications of that sank in. Suddenly, a dozen loose threads in her mind tied together, forming a tapestry. An explanation. That was why the fabrials of the tower, the pumps, the climbing mechanisms, didn't have gemstones with captive Spren. Storms! That was the answer to soul-casting devices. Awe Spren burst around her in a ring of blue smoke. Soulcasters didn't hold Spren, because they were Spren. Manifesting in the physical realm like shard blades, Spren became metal on this side. Somehow the ancient Spren had been coaxed into manifesting as soulcasters instead of blades. You didn't know, I see, Raboniel said, pulling a chair over for herself. Even sitting, she was a foot taller than Navani. She made such an odd image, a carapace-armored figure as if prepared for war, picking through notes. Odd that you should have made so many advances that we never dreamed of in epochs past. Yet you've forgotten the far simpler method your ancestors used. We didn't have access to Spren who would talk to us. Navani explained. Viv's golden keys. I can't believe we didn't see it. The implications. Lateral movement? Raboniel asked. Feeling almost in a daze, Navani sketched out the answer. We learned to isolate planes for conjoined fabrials, she explained. You have to use this construction of aluminum wires rigged to touch the gemstone. That maintains vertical position, but allows the gemstone to be moved horizontally. Fascinating, Raboniel said. Ralkalest, you call it aluminum in your language, interfering with the connection. That's quite ingenious. It must have taken a great deal of testing to get the correct configuration. Over a year's worth, Navani admitted. After the initial possibility was theorized, we have a problem that we can't move vertically and laterally at the same time. The fabrials that move us upward and downward are finicky, and we've been touching aluminum to them only after locking them into place. That's inconvenient. Yes, Navani said. But we found a system where we stop, then do our vertical motions. It can be a pain, since span reeds are very difficult to make work in moving vehicles.
It seems there should be a way to use this knowledge to make span reeds that can be used while moving, Raboniel said, inspecting Navani's sketch. That was my thought as well, Navani said. I put a small team on it, but we've been mostly occupied by other matters. Your weapons against our radiance still confuse me. Raboniel hummed to a quick and dismissive rhythm. Ancient technology, barely functional, she said. We can suck the stormlight from a radiant, yes, so long as they remain hanging there impaled by one of our weapons. This method does nothing to prevent the Spren from bonding a new radiant. I should like it if your Spren were easier to capture in gemstones.
I'll pass the request along, Navani said.
Raboniel hummed to a different rhythm, then smiled. It was difficult not to see the expression as predatory on her marbled face, with its lean danger. Yet there was also something tempting about the efficiency of this interaction. A few minutes of exchange, and Navani knew secrets she'd been trying to crack for decades.
This is how we end the war, Navani, Raboniel said, standing. With information shared.
And this ends the war how?
By showing everyone that our lives will all be improved by working together.
With the singers ruling.
Of course, Raboniel said. You are obviously a keen scholar, Navani Kulin. If you could improve the lives of your people manyfold, is that not worth abandoning self-governance? Look what we've done in mere minutes by sharing our knowledge.
Shared only because of your threats, Navani thought, careful not to show that on her face. This wasn't some free exchange. It doesn't matter what you tell me, Raboniel. You can reveal any secret you desire, because I'm in your power. You can just kill me once you have everything you want. She smiled at Raboniel, however.
I would like to check on my scholars, Lady of Wishes, to see how they're being treated, and find out the extent of our losses.
That made one point clear, Navani hoped. Some of her friends had been murdered. She was not simply going to forget about that.
Raboniel hummed, gesturing for Navani to join her. This was going to require a delicate balance, with both of them trying to play one another. Navani had to be explicitly careful not to let herself be taken in by Raboniel. That was one advantage Navani had over her scholars. She might never be worthy to join them, but she did have more experience with the real world of politics.
Raboniel and Navani entered the second of the two library rooms, the one with more desks and chairs. Navani's best, ardents and scholars alike, sat on the floor, heads bowed. They'd plainly been made to sleep here, judging by the spread-out blankets. A few looked up to see her, and she noted with relief that Rushu and Falalar were both unharmed. She did a quick count, immediately picking out the notable exceptions. She stepped over to Falalar, squatting down and asking,
Neshan?
Inabar?
Killed, Brightness, he said softly. They were in the Crystal Pillar Room, along with both of Neshan's wards, Ardent Vevanara, and a handful of unfortunate soldiers.
Navani winced. Pass the word, she whispered. For the time being, we are going to cooperate with the occupation. She stopped by Rushu next.
I'm glad you are well.
The Ardent, who had obviously been crying, nodded.
I was on my way down here to gather some scribes to help catalog the destruction up in that room when this happened. Brightness, do you think it's related?
In the chaos, Navani had nearly forgotten the strange explosion. Did you by chance find any infused spheres in the wreckage?
Specifically, a strange void light one?
No, Brightness, Rushu said. You saw the place. It was in shambles. But I did darken it to see if anything glowed, and saw nothing. Not a hint of stormlight, or even void light. As Navani had feared. Whatever that explosion had been, it had to be tied to the strange sphere, and that sphere was likely now gone. Navani stood and walked back to Raboniel. You didn't need to kill my scholars during your attack. They were no threat to you. Raboniel hummed to a quick-paced rhythm.
You will not be warned again, Navani. You will use my title when addressing me. I do not want to see you harmed, but there are proprieties thousands of years old that you will follow.
I understand, Lady of Wishes. I think putting my remaining people to work immediately would be good for morale. What would you like us to do?
To ease the transition, Raboniel said. Have them continue whatever they were doing before my arrival.
Many were working on fabrials, which will no longer function.
Have them do design sketches, then, Raboniel said, and write about the experiments they'd done before the occupation. I can see that their new theories get tested.
Did that mean there was a way to get fabrials working in the tower?
As you wish.
Then she got to work on the real problem, planning how she was going to get them out of this mess.
Kaladin was awakened by rain. He blinked, feeling mist on his face and seeing a jagged sky lit by spears of lightning frozen in place, not fading, just hanging there, framed by black clouds in a constant boil. He stared at the strange sight, then rolled to his side, half submerged in a puddle of frigid water. Was this Hearthstone? The war camps? No. Neither? He groaned, forcing himself to his feet. He didn't appear to be wounded, but his head was pounding. No weapons. He felt naked without a spear. Gusts of rain blew around him, the falling water moving in sheets, and he swore he could see the outlines of figures in the rainfall, as if it were making momentary shapes as it fell. The landscape was dark, evoking distant crags. He started through the water, surprised to see no spren around, not even rain spren. He thought he saw light atop a hill, so he started up the incline, careful not to lose his footing on the slick rock. A part of him wondered why he could see. The frozen, jagged lightning bolts didn't give off much illumination. Hadn't he been in a place like this once, with omnipresent light but a black sky? He stopped and stared upward, rain scouring his face. This was all wrong. This wasn't real, was it? Motion. Kaladin spun. A short figure moved down the hill toward him, emerging from the darkness. It seemed composed entirely of swirling gray mist with no features, though it wielded a spear. Kaladin caught the weapon with a quick turn of his hand, then twisted and pushed back in a classic disarming move. This phantom attacker wasn't terribly skilled, and Kaladin easily stole the weapon. Instinct took command, and he spun the spear and rammed it through the figure's neck. As the short figure dropped, two more appeared as if from nothing, both wielding spears of their own. Kaladin blocked one strike and threw the attacker off with a calculated shove, then spun and dropped the other with a sweep to the legs. He stabbed that figure with a quick thrust to the neck, then easily rammed his spear into the stomach of the other one as it stood up. Blood ran down the spear's shaft onto Kaladin's fingers. He yanked the spear free as the smoky figure dropped. It felt good to hold a spear, to be able to fight without worries, without anything weighing him down other than the rainwater on his uniform. Fighting used to be simple, before... The swirling mist evaporated off the fallen figures, and he found three young messenger boys in Amaram's colors, killed by Kaladin's spear. Three corpses, including his brother.
No!
Kaladin screamed, ragged and hateful. How dare you show me this? It didn't happen that way! I was there! He turned away from the corpses, looking toward the sky.
I didn't kill him! I just failed him! I just...
He stumbled away from the dead boys and dropped his spear, hands to his head. He felt the scars on his forehead. They seemed deeper, like chasms cutting through his skull. Shash. Dangerous. Thunder rumbled overhead, and he stumbled downhill, unable to banish the sight of Tien dead and bleeding on the hillside. What kind of terrible vision was this?
"You saved us so we could die," a voice said from the darkness.
He knew that voice. Kaladin spun, splashing in the rainwater, searching for the source. He was on the shattered plains now. In the rain, he saw the suggestions of people, figures made by the falling drops, but somehow empty. The figures began attacking each other, and he heard the thunder of war. Men shouting, weapons clashing, boots on stone. It surrounded him, overwhelmed him, until, in a flash, he emerged into an enormous battle, the suggested shapes becoming real. Men in blue fighting against other men in blue.
"Stop fighting!" Kaladin shouted at them. "You're killing your own! They're all our soldiers!"
They didn't seem to hear him. Blood flowed beneath his feet instead of rainwater, sprays and gushes melding as spearmen climbed eagerly over the bodies of the fallen to continue killing one another. Kaladin grabbed one spearman and pushed him away from another, then seized a third and pulled him back, only to find that it was Lopin.
"Lopin," Kaladin said, "listen to me! Stop fighting!"
Lopin bared his teeth in a terrible grin, then knocked Kaladin aside before launching himself at yet another figure, Rock, who had stumbled on a corpse. Lopin killed him with a spear through the gut, but then Teft killed Lopin from behind. Bissig stabbed Teft, and Kaladin didn't see who brought him down. He was too horrified. Sigzil dropped nearby with a hole in his side, and Kaladin caught him.
"Why?" Sigzil asked, blood dribbling from his lips. "Why didn't you let us sleep? This isn't real. This can't be real. You should have let us die on the shattered plains. I wanted to protect you," Kaladin shouted. "I had to protect you. You cursed us."
Kaladin dropped the dying body and stumbled away. He ducked his head, his mind cloudy, and started running. A part of him knew this horror wasn't real, but he could still hear the screaming, accusing him. "Why did you do this, Kaladin? Why have you killed us?" He pressed his hands to his ears, so intent on escaping the carnage that he nearly ran straight into a chasm. He pulled up, teetering on the edge. He stumbled, then looked to his left. The war camps were there, up a short slope. He'd been here. He remembered this place, this storm, lightly raining, this chasm, where he'd nearly died.
"You saved us," a voice said, "so we could suffer."
Moash. He stood on the edge of the chasm near Kaladin. The man turned, and Kaladin saw his eyes, black pits.
"People think you were merciful to us, but we both know the truth, don't we? You did it for you, not us. If you were truly merciful, you'd have given us easy deaths."
"No," Kaladin said. "No!"
"The void awaits, Cal," Moash said. "The emptiness. It lets you do anything, even kill a king without regret. One step. You'll never have to feel pain again."
Moash took a step and dropped into the chasm. Kaladin fell to his knees on the edge, rain streaming around him. He stared down in horror, then started awake, someplace cold. Immediately, 100 pains coursed through his joints and muscles, each demanding his attention like a screaming child. He groaned and opened his eyes, but there was only darkness. "I'm in the tower," he thought, remembering the events of the previous day. "Storms. The place is controlled by the fused. I barely got away." The nightmares seemed to be getting worse. Or they'd always been this bad, but he didn't remember. He lay there, breathing deeply, sweating as if from exertion, and remembered the sight of his friends dying. Remembered Moash stepping into that darkness and vanishing. Sleeping was supposed to refresh you, but Kaladin felt more tired than when he'd collapsed. He groaned and put his back to the wall, forcing himself to sit up. Then he felt around in a sudden panic. In his addled state, a part of him thought for sure he'd find Teft dead on the floor. He let out a sigh of relief as he located his friend lying nearby, still breathing. The man had wet himself, unfortunately. He'd grow dehydrated quickly if Kaladin didn't do something, and the potential for rotspren was high if Kaladin didn't get him cleaned up and properly situated with a bedpan. Storms. The weight of what Kaladin had done hung above him, nearly as oppressive as the weight of the tower. He was alone, lost in the darkness, without stormlight or anything to drink, let alone proper weapons. He needed to take care of not only himself, but a man in a coma. What had he been thinking? He didn't believe the nightmare, but he couldn't completely banish its echoes either. Why? Why couldn't he have let go? Why did he keep fighting? Was it really for them? Or was it because he was selfish? Because he couldn't let go and admit defeat? Syl, he asked in the darkness. When she didn't answer him, he called again, his voice trembling. Syl, where are you? No reply. He felt around his enclosure and realized he had no idea how to get out. He'd entombed himself and Teft here in this too-thick darkness, to die slow deaths alone. Then a pinprick of light appeared. Syl, blessedly, entered the enclosure. She couldn't pass through walls. Radiant Spren had enough substance in the physical realm that they were impeded by most materials. Instead, she appeared to have come in through some sort of vent high in the wall. Her appearance brought with it a measure of his sanity. He released a shuddering breath as she flitted down and landed on his outstretched palm.
I found a way out, she said, taking the shape of a soldier wearing a scout uniform. I don't think you'd be able to get through it, though. Even a child would be cramped. I looked around, though I couldn't go too far. Guards are posted at many stairwells, but they don't seem to be searching for you. These floors are big enough that I think they've realized finding one man in here is virtually impossible.
That's some good news, I guess, Kaladin said. Do you have any idea what that light was that led me in here?
I have a theory, Syl said. A long time ago, before things went poorly between Spren and humans, there were three bondsmiths. One was the Stormfather, one for the Night Watcher, and one other, for a Spren called the Sibling, a Spren who remained in this tower, hidden, and did not appear to humans. They were supposed to have died long ago.
Huh, Kaladin said, feeling at the door that had opened to let him in. What were they like?
I don't know, Syl said, moving to his shoulder. We've talked to Brightness Navani about this, answering her questions, and the other Radiant Spren didn't know more than I just said. Remember, many of the Spren who knew about the old days died, and the Sibling was always secretive. I don't know what kind of Spren they were, or why they could create a bondsmith. If they are alive, though, I don't know why so much in the tower doesn't work.
Well, this wall worked, Kaladin said, finding the gemstone in the wall. The gem was dark now, but it was also much more prominent on this side. He could easily have missed it from the other direction. How many other rooms had such gemstones embedded in the wall, hiding secret doors? He touched the gemstone. Despite the fact that he didn't have any more stormlight, light appeared deep inside it. A white light that twinkled like a star. It expanded into a small burst of stormlight, and the door suddenly split open again. Kaladin let out a long breath and felt a little of his panic wash away. He wouldn't die in the darkness. Once the gemstone was charged, it worked like any other fabrial, continuing to function so long as it had remaining stormlight. He looked to Syl. Think you can find your way back here to Teft if we leave and do some scouting?
I should be able to memorize our path.
Great, Kaladin said, because we need supplies. He couldn't afford to think about the long term yet. Those daunting questions, what he was going to do about the tower, the dozens of radiants in enemy captivity, his family, would need to wait. First, he needed water, food, stormlight, and most importantly, a better weapon.
Annotated map of the war in Emul. Emul is to the southeast of Aesir and southwest of the mountains where Urethiru is located. Odium's forces control the southern half of the country, including the Dronmu Basin. The Coalition's forces control the northern half. The town of Lucky is just inside the Emuli border, due east of Azamir. Ishar's army has been seen in the northeastern corner of Tukar, south of the Dronmu Basin.
47. A Cage of Forged Spirits. I approached this project with inspiration renewed. The answers are all that should matter. From Rhythm of War, page 1, undertext. The wood lurched under Delinar's feet, and he grabbed a railing to steady himself.
Skybreakers! He shouted. Trying to get at the Fabrail housings!
Two figures in blue leaped off the deck nearby, bursting with light as the platform continued to shake. Two wouldn't be able to handle this. Storm it, where was... Sigzil and his force of 10 windrunners came swooping back, striking at the underside of the flying formation. It wasn't truly a flying machine like the Fourth Bridge, but these platforms were nevertheless an excellent vantage for viewing a battlefield, assuming they didn't get attacked. Delinar held firm to the railing, glancing at the Mink, who was tethered to Delinar with a rope. The shorter man was grinning wildly as he clung to the railing. Fortunately, the platform soon stopped lurching and the skybreakers scattered, trailed by figures in blue with spears.
Fewer heavenly ones than I'd have expected, Delinar noted as the wind ruffled his hair.
He picked out only 4 of the flying fused watching the battlefield from above and occasionally delivering instructions to the ground troops. They didn't engage.
They're leaning on the skybreakers for this battle.
Perhaps the bulk of the heavenly ones were with the main enemy forces, stationed several days' march away. The Mink leaned out over the side of the platform, trying to get a view directly beneath, where radiants were clashing. He didn't seem at all bothered by the 300-yard drop to the ground. For a man who always seemed so paranoid, he could certainly be cavalier regarding danger. Beneath them, the battle lines held formation. Delinar's troops, augmented by ranks of Azish, fought Taravangian's treasonous forces, who had tried to strike inward to rescue their king. The Vaidens were accompanied by a small number of fused and some singer troops, a small enough force to have moved in close without detection before the betrayal. On Delinar's platform, some 50 archers reformed their ranks following the chaos of the sudden skybreaker attack. In moments, they were sending a hail of arrows on the Vaidens.
They'll break soon, the Mink said softly, surveying the battlefield. Their line is bowing. Those Azish fight well. Better than I thought they would.
They have excellent discipline, Delinar agreed. They simply needed proper direction.
Any given Azish soldier was no match for an Alethi, but after witnessing their discipline this last year, Delinar was grateful he'd never had to face their infantry in battle. The vast blocks of Azish pikes were less mobile than the Alethi equivalent, but were impeccably coordinated. They were a tremendous addition to an Alethi system, which had far more flexibility and a variety of specialized troops. Using Azish blocks like wedges and Alethi tactics, they'd been able to stand against the enemy despite their natural advantages, like carapace armor and stronger builds. And the Vaiden traitors? Well, the Mink was right. The enemy line was beginning to bow and crack. They had no cavalry, and the Mink made a quiet order to one of the waiting scribes who transferred it. Delinar guessed, correctly, he'd ordered a harrying strike of light riders along the left flank. Those filled the Vaiden back rows with arrows, distracting them to further stress the wavering lines.
Oh, I do have to admit, the Mink said to Delinar as they watched, bowstrings snapping behind them. This is an excellent way to oversee a battlefield.
And you were worried about there being no escape?
Rather, the Mink said, looking toward the ground below. I was worried about all avenues of escape being interrupted by an unfortunate collision with the ground. Still don't know the wisdom of putting us both up here. Seems like we should be on separate platforms, so that if one falls, the other can continue to lead our forces.
You mistake my purpose, Giono, Dalinar said, tugging on the rope that bound them. My job in this battle isn't to command if you are killed. It's to get you out before you are killed.
One of Jasnah's escape boats waited on the other side in Shadesmar. In an emergency, Dalinar could get himself and the Mink through the perpendicularity. They'd drop a short distance, but not nearly as far as they would on this side, into a padded ship with mandras hooked in place. The Mink, unsurprisingly, didn't like that escape route. He couldn't control it. In truth, Dalinar wasn't 100% comfortable with it himself. He didn't fully trust his powers yet. His mastery over them was tenuous. He opened the perpendicularity as the Windrunners approached for more stormlight. He managed to open it only a sliver, renewing those nearby but preventing the Skybreakers from partaking. They retreated. Skybreakers couldn't match Windrunners, who were being constantly renewed, and were usually deployed on battlefields where Dalinar was not present. As the Mink took casualty reports, which included two Windrunner squires, unfortunately, a young scribe stepped up to Dalinar with a sheaf of papers and a blinking span read.
"Word from Urethiru, Brightlord," she said. "You wanted to know as soon as we heard something, and we have."
Dalinar felt a huge weight slide off his shoulders.
"Finally! What is happening?"
"Trouble with the Tower Fabrials," the scribe reported. "Brightness Navani saw that some kind of strange defensive aura had been deployed, preventing Radiants from using their powers. It also interferes with Fabrials. She had to send a scouting team out along the ridge into the mountains before they were able to deliver her message. Everyone is safe and she's working on the problem. That is why the oath gates have stopped working, however. She begs for your patience and asks if anything strange has happened here."
"Tell her about Taravangian's betrayal," Dalinar said, "but report that I'm safe, as is our family. We are fighting the traitors and should soon win the day."
She nodded and went to send the message. The Mink stepped closer. He'd either overheard or had received a similar report.
"They're trying to confuse and distract us during the betrayal," he said, "heaping attacks on multiple fronts."
"Another ploy to negate the Oath Gates," Dalinar agreed. "That device they used on High Marshal Kaladin must have been some sort of test. They've knocked out Urethiru for a while to isolate us."
The Mink leaned out, squinting at the armies below.
"Something about this smells wrong, Blackthorn. If this was merely a ploy to isolate the fighting in Aesir and Emil, they've made a tactical mistake. Their forces in this part of the land are exposed, and we have the upper hand. They wouldn't go through so much effort to block us from the Oath Gates unless it were truly cutting off our escape route. Which it won't, because we're not going to need one."
"You think this is a distraction from something else?"
The Mink nodded slowly. Far below, the cavalry did another sweep. The line of the traitors buckled further.
"I'll tell the others to watch out," Dalinar said, "and send scouts to investigate Urethiru. I agree. Something about this is off."
"Make certain the armies we're going to fight in Emul haven't been secretly reinforced. That could be terrible for us. The only true disaster I can envision here is Azimir being besieged and unable to be resupplied via the Oath Gates. Having seen that city, I'd hate to be trapped there."
"Agreed," Dalinar said.
The Mink leaned out further, precariously, as he watched the battlefield below. It was hard to hear, muffled clangs, shouts from far away. Men moved like lifespren. But Dalinar could smell the sweat, could hear the roar, could feel himself standing among the struggling, screaming, dying bodies, and dominating with blade in hand. Once you'd tasted the near invincibility of wearing plate and wading in among mortals, it was a difficult flavor to forget.
"You miss it," the Mink said, eyeing him.
"Yes," Dalinar admitted.
"I could use you on the ground. Down there I'd merely be another sword,
I can do more in other positions. Pardon, Blackthorn, but you were never merely another sword.
The mink crossed his arms, leaning against the wooden railing.
You keep saying you're more use elsewhere, and I suppose you make a pretty good storm for renewing spheres. But I can sense you stepping away. What are you planning?
That was the question. He sensed there was so much more for him to do. Greater things, important things, the tasks of a bondsmith. But getting to them, figuring them out.
They're breaking, the mink said, standing up straight. You want to let them go, or pin them and crush them?
What do you think? Dalinar asked.
I hate fighting men who feel they have no way out, the mink said. We can't afford to let them reinforce the enemy to the south, Dalinar said.
That would be their true battlefield once this skirmish was over. The war for Emul.
Keep pressing them until they surrender.
The mink began giving the orders. Far below, drums washed over the battlefield, the frantic attempts by enemy commanders to maintain discipline as the lines disintegrated. He could almost hear their shouted, panic-tinged cries, desperation in the air.
The mink is right, Dalinar thought. They made a real effort here to strike at us, but something is wrong. We're missing a piece of the enemy's plan.
As he was watching, a nondescript soldier stepped up beside him. Dalinar had brought only a handful of bodyguards today, three men from the Cobalt Guard, and a single shard-bearer. Cord, the horn-eater woman, who had taken it upon herself to join his guards for reasons he didn't quite understand. He also held a hidden weapon. The man who stood beside him, so ordinary in his Alethi uniform, holding a sheathed sword that was admittedly longer than regulation. Zeth, the assassin in white, wearing a false face. He didn't speak, though the complex light weaving he wore would disguise his voice. He simply watched, his eyes narrowed. What did he see in this battlefield? What had caught his attention? Zeth suddenly grabbed Dalinar by the front of his uniform and towed him to the side. Dalinar barely had time to shout in surprise as a glowing figure rose up beside the archer platform, radiant with stormlight and bearing a silvery blade. Zeth stepped between Dalinar and the Skybreaker, hand going to his sword, but Dalinar caught him by the arm, preventing him from drawing it. Once that weapon came out, dangerous things happened. They would want to be absolutely certain it was needed before unleashing it. The figure was familiar to Dalinar. Dark brown skin with a birthmark on his cheek. Nalan, called Nail, herald and leader of the Skybreakers. He had shaved his head recently and held out his blade in a defiant, perhaps challenging posture as he addressed Dalinar.
Bondsmith, Nail said, your war is unjust. You must submit to the laws of the...
An arrow slammed into his face, dead center, interrupting him. Dalinar glanced back, then stopped Cord, who was drawing her shard bow again.
Wait, I'd hear him.
Nail, with a suffering expression, pulled the arrow free and dropped it, letting his stormlight heal him. Could this man be killed? Ash said the enemy had somehow killed Jezrian, but before, when heralds died, their souls had returned to damnation to await torture. Nail didn't continue his diatribe. He lightly stepped up onto the railing of the platform, then dropped to the deck. He tossed his blade away, letting it vanish to mist in midair.
How are you a bondsmith? Nail asked Dalinar. You should not exist, Blackthorn. Your cause is not righteous. You should be denied the true surges of honor.
Perhaps it is a sign that you are wrong, Nalan, Dalinar said. Perhaps our cause is righteous.
No, Nail said. Other Radiants can lie to themselves and their spren. So-called honor spren prove that morality is shaped by their perceptions. You should be different. Honor should not allow this bonding.
Honor is dead, Dalinar said.
And yet, Nail said, honor still should prevent this. Prevent you.
He looked Dalinar up and down.
No shard blade. Fair enough.
He launched forward, reaching for Dalinar. Zeth was upon him in a moment, but hesitated to draw his strange blade. Nail moved with a Skyeel's grace, twisting Zeth about and slamming him to the deck of the wooden platform. The herald slapped aside Zeth's sheathed sword, punching him in the crook of the elbow and making him drop his weapon. Nail casually reached up and caught the arrow launched from Cord's shard bow mere feet away, an inhuman feat. Dalinar pressed his hands together, reaching beyond reality for the perpendicularity. Nail leaped over Zeth toward Dalinar as the others on the platform shouted, trying to react to the attack.
No,
the Stormfather said to Dalinar.
Touch him.
Dalinar hesitated, the power of the perpendicularity at his fingertips, then reached out and pressed his hand to Nail's chest as the herald reached for him. Flash! Dalinar saw Nail stepping away from a discarded blade rammed into the stone. Flash! Nail cradling a child in one arm, his blade out as dark forces crawled across a ridge nearby. Flash! Nail standing with a group of scholars and unrolling a large writ filled with writing.
The law cannot be moral, Nail said to them, but you can be moral as you create laws. Ever must you protect the weakest, those most likely to be taken advantage of. Institute a right of movement so that a family who feels their lord is unrighteous can leave this area. Then tie a lord's authority to the people who follow him.
Flash. Nail kneeling before a high spren. Flash. Nail fighting on a battlefield. Flash. Another fight. Flash. Another fight. The visions came faster and faster. Dalinar could no longer distinguish one from another until flash. Nail clasping hands with a bearded Alethi man, regal and wise. Dalinar knew this was Ysereza, though he couldn't say how.
I will take this charge, Nail said softly, with honor.
Do not consider it an honor, Ysereza said. A duty, yes, but not an honor.
I understand, though I had not expected you would come to an enemy with this offer.
An enemy, yes, Ysereza said. But an enemy who was correct all along, making me the villain, not you. We will fix what we've broken. Ishar and I agreed. There is no person we would welcome more eagerly into this pact than you. You are the single most honorable man I have ever had the privilege of opposing.
I wish that were true, Nail said, but I will serve as best I can.
The vision faded and Nail lurched away from Dalinar, gasping, his eyes wide. He left a line of light stretching between him and Dalinar.
Bond Smith,
the Stormfather said in Dalinar's mind.
You forged a brief connection with him. What did you see?
His past, I think, Dalinar whispered. And now...
Nail scratched at his head, and Dalinar saw a skeletal figure overlapping him, like the echo of light that followed Zeth, only worn, dim. Dalinar stepped forward, walking among his stunned bodyguards, noting 8 lines of light extending from Nail into the distance.
I see the Oath Pact, I think, Dalinar said. The thing that bound them together and made them capable of holding the enemy in damnation.
A cage forged of their spirits,
the Stormfather said in his mind.
It was broken. Even before Jezreel's death, they shattered it by what they did long ago.
No, only one line of it is completely broken. The rest are here, but weak. Impotent.
Dalinar pointed to one line, bright and powerful.
Except one. Still vibrant.
Nail looked up at him, then ripped free of the line of light connecting him to Dalinar and threw himself off the platform. The herald burst alight and shot away as, belatedly, a few windrunners came to Dalinar's aid.
You wield the power of gods, Dalinar, the Stormfather said. I once thought I knew the extent of your abilities. I have abandoned that ignorant supposition.
Could I reforge it? Dalinar asked.
Could I remake the Oath Pact and bind the fused away again?
I do not know. It may be possible, but I have no idea how, or if it would be wise. The heralds suffer for what they did.
I saw that in him, Dalinar said, watching as Nail vanished in the distance. He is burdened with a terrible pain that warps how he sees reality. An insanity unlike the ones that afflict ordinary men. An insanity that has to do with his worn soul.
Zeth recovered his sword, seeming ashamed he'd been so easily bested. Dalinar did not fault him, nor the others, who insisted that he and the Mink retreat from the battlefield, now that the rout of Terebangian's troops was fully in progress. Dalinar let the Windrunners spirit him away. All the while, he was lost in thought. He needed to understand his powers. His duty was no longer to stand with a sword held high, shouting orders on the battlefield. He instead needed to find a way to use his abilities to solve this war. Reforge the Oath Pact, or, barring that, find another solution. One that included binding Odium once and for all.
48. Scent of Death. Scent of Life.